What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Hi, everybody, and here's what's ahead of us. Big layoffs, warnings from food companies, and some cautious Fed speak today. Is the economy showing any signs of losing momentum here? We'll ask as the Dow turns positive for 2020. And if you think the gains in the tech stocks have been impressive, you should look at the electric car stocks. We're talking gains of 200, 300, even 400% in just 3 months. Is it sustainable? And which ones are due for a pullback? We will dive into that. And the PC is back. Facebook calls out Apple. Can you sue over a bad stock? And Ulta's makeover. It's all ahead in rapid fire, but we begin with the markets. Rahel Solomon here to do the honors. Rahel?
Oh, hello, Kelly. Happy Friday. And it is green across the board. All three averages up about 0.5% right now. As you mentioned, Kelly, the Dow has given up its 2020 losses. And we have got one more August trading day after today, but it looks like the major averages are poised for their best August gains in decades. The S&P and Dow on track for their best August since the 1980s. That was a good decade. And among the big gainers for this week are the cloud and software stocks. Take a look. Workday, a big mover today after strong results last night. Also up about 27% this week. Let's get that too. Box up 13%, although you can see it's under pressure today. And Salesforce up 30% for the week, although also under pressure today, down about 2.5%. And finally, let's take a look, one of our last, at Apple before its stock split ahead of the market open on Monday. Can never talk too much Apple, Kelly. This month alone, the stock is responsible for a whopping 24% of the Dow's gain. At its current price, it is the most influential component of the Dow. That, of course, will change in a big way come Monday, Kelly.
Wow, it will. There's so much coming on Monday. The Tesla split, the Apple split, the Dow components. Very exciting, Rahel. We'll see you then. Thank you. The market rally does continue with the Dow erasing those annual losses. But today's some weaker economic headlines. Consumer spending rose for a third straight month in July, but the pace of growth is slowing. Capital One reportedly tightening some card limits, and food companies are warning about slowing spending. On the jobs front, Coca-Cola offering voluntary buyouts to 4,000 workers, while MGM Resorts is cutting 18,000 jobs. So are these market gains in jeopardy? With me now are Jason Dreho, head of America's Asset Allocation at UBS Global Wealth Management, and Tracy McMillan is head of Global Asset Allocation Strategy at Wells Fargo Investment Institute. Good to have you both here. Jason, I'll ask you, think the economy can keep performing, or does it need a little bit more assistance here?
So the momentum for the economy is still strong. I mean, we're going to see a moderation of the pace of recovery from earlier in the spring and the summer. I think the concern for the economy at this point in time, though, is whether consumer spending can hold up because of the fiscal stimulus package hasn't been passed yet. So far, the consumer spending has been quite strong, and that should stay the case. But that thing is sort of the near-term risk, is that if we don't get something in September, there is a risk that the consumer could start to kind of pull back a little bit. That would put some of the recovery at risk.
Yeah, Tracy, are you kind of, would you say that's priced in? I mean, we thought we were going to have this big deal in Washington. Now maybe it's a skinnier deal, a smaller one, but it's still something, although, you know, nothing's done until the ink is dried, so to speak. What are your expectations?
Yes, we also think that the consumer is under quite a bit of stress here. Unemployment levels continue to be very high. Claims came in again this week at 1 million. So another 1 million people unemployed. So that is definitely weighing on the consumer. So the key here is, do we get that additional stimulus or not? And our belief is that we will get the stimulus. It could take some additional weakness in the consumer. It could even take some market weakness before Congress comes together and passes that package. But that's really what we think it's going to take.
Jason, where would you be in the market? I mean, as we're talking about these risks, especially, you know, the consumer confidence number this week was not great. So, you know, you could say as an investor, all right, you have to think through these scenarios. It weakens a little bit. We get the move from Congress. Boom. We can kind of look through to the other side. Are you rotating? You know, where are you? Tell me about, tactically speaking, what's your advice here?
So we're not rotating. Like, we do like equities. We think there's still more upside. You know, I think we're going to get that fiscal policy package. And it's also, you know, on the medical front, things are progressing there that, you know, I think will buoy the market. It's going to keep the market from pulling back too much. But it's this rotation that the market's been debating about in terms of growth versus value. You know, we're neutral there. Where we'd like to get some more maybe exposure to potential recovery is in mid-cap equities. Typically, they perform well in the recovery stage, and they haven't outperformed just yet, but we think that's going to kick in. And it doesn't quite have the exposure to, say, financials that the value trade would have. And then in terms of kind of the global recovery, industrials is another sector that we like. So we're kind of dipping our toes, you could say, into like adding a little bit of cyclical exposure and recovery. We still think that's going to materialize. I think until we get a clear sign of a full-scale recovery, I think that's going to require a vaccine. I think that's the market consensus. You're not going to get that sustained rotation. So I think just overall being allocated to equities versus fixed income, but not being sort of overly aggressive in terms of taking cyclical risk at this time.
I mean, that's interesting that you think we're not going to have a real rotation into the value names until we get a vaccine. I mean, I'd have to think a lot of people, Tracy, are going to rotate before that if they think we're on track, or maybe not. Maybe you just have to wait and see on this one. I know you guys are looking at things more globally speaking, but, you know, same question I just asked. Jason, what would your advice to investors be here?
Yeah, so, you know, with the news from the Fed yesterday about keeping rates lower for longer and the inflation average targeting, that means that now investors really have to stop and think, you know, do you want to be in cash earning nothing? Do you want to be in a treasury earning 75 basis points, call it? Or do you want to take more risk and move into high yield where you're getting that additional yield? Do you want to be in the large cap stocks where you're getting a dividend of 1.73%? And we think that means that there's this rotation out of the safer asset classes into those riskier asset classes. And that's where we're telling investors we want them to go, especially if we see a pullback here in the next couple of months. So large caps, mid caps over small, U.S. over domestic over international, and high yield over investment grade.
All right. Well, I haven't heard this much enthusiasm for mid cap stocks and maybe ever. Thank you both very much for joining me today. It's been a pleasure. Jason Dreho and Tracy McMillan. Meantime, everyone seems to want a piece of TikTok as speculation grows around who could end up buying the app while the clock keeps ticking on a potential shutdown of it in the U.S. It's a lot to handle for TikTok's new interim CEO. Julia Boorstin caught up with her earlier today. She joins us now with more. Julia.
Well, Kelly, TikTok's new interim head, Victoria Pappas, taking the helm after the abrupt departure of TikTok CEO Kevin Mayer. Pappas tells us she's not directly involved in deal negotiations, but here's what she said when I asked her which buyer would make the most sense.
If you look at the various players and the partners that we're hearing from, I think they're amazing tech companies. You know, Oracle has its strengths in terms of being a leading data infrastructure company and focused on security. Microsoft as well, a great security and privacy platform, as well as everything they're doing with the cloud. So yeah, I think amazing, reputable companies, and we're certainly flattered for that.
As for Walmart joining Microsoft's bid, Vanessa Pappas, sorry, I got that wrong earlier. Vanessa Pappas said Walmart is interesting, pointing to natural synergies and saying that TikTok has been rolling out e-commerce features. Pappas telling us that she's confident about the future success of TikTok, even as they prepare for all potential contingencies, including the potential that the app could be shut down. Kelly?
Julia, with all these distractions, with all the questions about its future viability still hanging over TikTok with this potential ownership change, what about rivals? There's plenty out there who would love to steal TikTok's thunder. Instagram launched, what's it called, Reels. I mean, is this giving a bigger opening to others to come in?
You're absolutely right, Kelly. I asked her about Facebook's Reels, which it just rolled out here in the U.S. a couple weeks ago. She really just stressed, she returned to her party line, stressed the positivity and the enthusiasm of creators for TikTok. She did say specifically that they have not seen a decrease either in terms of their users or in terms of creators or advertisers due to all of this noise around the potential deal and the potential shutdown. So there's certainly a lot of companies, not just Facebook, also apps such as Triller, trying to get some of that activity that TikTok has really tapped into, that user base, the young user base that's so hard to reach. But she says it hasn't really had an impact just yet.
Yeah, and we'll see if that changes after everything that happens in the weeks and months ahead. Julia, thanks very much. Great stuff. Julia Borson speaking with the new interim CEO of TikTok USA, I should say. Coming up, forget Apple and Amazon. If you're looking for gains, head to the electric vehicle market. We're talking moves of more than 300%. We'll look at the charts to see who may be due for a breakdown. Plus, Facebook claims Apple silenced them when it came to transparency over the App Store pricing. We've got the details and the evolutions of Jay Powell. We're back after this quick break.
Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones, from powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY, a big idea that inspired the world to invest differently, and still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Welcome back. Electric vehicles are turning heads these days. Well, the stocks are anyway, because they're making some pretty electric moves. Tesla, of course, the biggest in market cap. It's up more than 440% this year, but there's more. How about Workhorse Group? Got a big jolt this summer, up more than 550% in 3 months. And just this week, NIO, the Chinese EV maker, up more than 30%. With more on these moves, we're joined by Matt Maley, the chief market strategist at Miller Tabak, and David Whiston, an analyst over at Morningstar. Matt, I'll start with you. We've seen charts like this before. How do they end?
Not good. Not good. And again, it doesn't mean that these aren't good companies. I mean, sometimes the stock is well ahead of the fundamentals and gets way overbought and way overowned, way overloved, et cetera. And that's what we're seeing in Tesla. I mean, you look at the chart, the weekly RSI chart, it's a reading of over 85 today. That's very close to its all-time high.
Wow.
And it's at a 450% premium to its 200-week moving average. The next closest one is only 250% premium. So this stock has gotten way ahead of itself. I think it could come back significantly, 20 to 30%. Actually, if it fell 60%, it would still be above its February highs.
Wow.
I don't think it's going to fall that much. But the point is, sometimes stocks get way ahead of themselves. If you'd asked me in June, I would have said, buy Tesla, not Nikola. Now I'm saying just the opposite, because Nikola has actually come in quite a bit, and its chart looks much better.
Oh, interesting. David, you talked to CNBC Pro about this, and I thought the quote was so interesting. You said a lot of these firms won't make it. They'll linger around for a while. There's easy money. And also saying that part of this is the excitement over this SPAC model, saying it's putting gasoline on that fire, so to speak. Tell me a little bit about whether you'd be kind of tactically differentiating one car maker versus another here, or if the price action for all of them to you seems like a warning.
The whole space in terms of startup EVs and also Tesla, that's not really a startup anymore. It's a momentum play, pure and simple. I think it's a bubble, quite honestly. Tesla up roughly 70% just on announcing a stock split. That doesn't make any sense to me. Yes, there's more appeal to retail investors with the split announcement, but 70%, I mean, come on, it just doesn't make sense. It's a frustrating sector to cover. And that quote you referenced, I'm talking more on these startups that, you know, they've got their vehicle and they've got some funding, and that's great. But Elon himself talks about this. It's incredibly difficult to make something right consistently and at scale. Tesla, despite its market cap size, is not that big of a company still in terms of vehicle volumes. They'll do probably 400,000 units this year. They're targeting 500,000. That's going to be tough. But it's a bubble, and eventually you're going to need more money. And Rivian has Amazon and Ford backing, but not everyone is so lucky. So it remains to be seen, especially once rates come up.
Yeah. No, and it's interesting to hear you characterize it that way, because like you said, you covered this space. I mean, these are your companies. In a way, it makes it much more difficult for you when the price action goes this way. So, Matt, what would you do if you're Elon Musk? I mean, he's already issued more stock. He's said the stock price is too high. He's very wealthy as a result of where the stock price is now. But if it collapses, you know, obviously that would kind of be a headache of its own. Is this going to go the way of the cannabis stocks, of, you know, other subsectors of the market that we've seen where they have this tremendous hype? The price has basically collapsed. Everybody else moves on. No one really notices. Or are there bigger ramifications for all investors here and for the market?
Well, one of the things, yes, I do think it could go the way of the cannabis stocks. whether it can bounce back like it has on many different occasions, something the cannabis stocks haven't been able to do, that's another question. But that doesn't mean it can't fall and fall substantially. I mean, you're talking about the retail and how that's got all involved. But we also have to remember the algos. I mean, they're run more by institutions, but they're momentum-driven trades. They get zero credit when the market rallies or when a stock rallies, but it's played a big impact on that. The problem is when it reverses, they will be selling into a down tape, into a down stock, and doing so aggressive. They'll get a lot of blame at that point. But the real the issue is that it's going to inflict some pain on some individual investors. That's going to spill over to some other stocks, especially since so many others are high-flying as well, maybe not as much. So I'm concerned that Tesla and the Apples of the world, Apple's a great, great company, but its stock is overbought. It could cause the rest of the market to pull back, even with the Fed on the sidelines, ready to step in if things get really bad. But that doesn't keep us from seeing a 10% correction or more in the stock market, yeah, and a significant correction in Tesla.
So, David, Matt mentioned earlier, pullback in Nikola could make that more attractive here, at least, amongst the names that we're talking about. Are there any valuations to you that are compelling? And what happens to these companies if their stock price reverses and drops by 50, 60, 70%?
Yeah, and I should say I only cover Tesla. I don't cover any of the startups. I don't cover Nikola or Neo or anyone like that. But so on my coverage list, I mean, GM has an EV story that's very, very misunderstood, and not they're not getting enough credit for that, nor are they getting credit for their Cruise AV business, for example. I think in terms of you're asking more on these startups, what's going to happen? Well, I think honestly, eventually some of them will probably have a hard time getting either one product to market or multiple products to market. And then at that point, they'll probably get into distress. Something else with the economy might happen. Remember, we're still in a recession and a pandemic and unemployment's quite high. That's not good for auto sales, generally speaking, but wealthy people can afford a Tesla for now. Eventually, though, you've got to get bigger. You've got to get more scale. You can't just keep selling one vehicle that's awesome but costs $150,000 or something. Just long-term for scale.
I appreciate David Whiston again making the case for people to think about GM maybe the same way that they're thinking about some of these newer high flyers. Thank you both very much today. Great discussion. Matt Maley and David Whiston talking about the electric vehicle stocks. Coming up, the iPad gets all the love, but the PC is back, baby. HP and Dell proving that today. We will look at their numbers. Both stocks up about 6%. Plus, Stifel says one group of stocks will gain the most when there's a vaccine breakthrough, with some names you may not have heard of. And the president's new tax cut goes into effect next week, but there's a lot more questions than answers right now. We'll look at the payroll tax dilemma coming up.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.
Welcome back to The Exchange. Let's get a check on the markets. We're close to session highs. The Dow is up 144 at that point. We're up 117 right now, about 0.4% gain. And we're pretty close to positive territory now on the year, which is amazing if you think about it with the pandemic and everything that's happened. The S&P, by the way, up about 8% now on the year. The Nasdaq's up 30%. And we're seeing slight gains across all of them today. Let's turn to the sectors. Yesterday, financials were a rare leadership spot holder. Today, not so much. But energy is leading the way. So once again, some of the less favored sectors are in the leadership. Energy up 1%, materials up there as well. Underperformers, healthcare, real estate, but only by a little bit. Let's talk about some of the individual movers today as well. Shares of DraftKings are lower on a downgrade to equal weight from overweight at Morgan Stanley. Valuation concerns at play there. Also, they're talking about a reversal of the stay-at-home trade, a lack of stimulus checks, and increased competition potential headwinds. DraftKings down about 4% right now. And shares of athletic maker Hibbett higher after crushing earnings. Their same-store sales were up 79%. Digital sales more than tripled in the quarter, and Hibbett's up 4.5%. Finally, take a look at Peloton, which just continues to surge to new highs. We're up another 8.8% today. We're up 160% now since the IPO last September. Just incredible growth story there. Let's get over to Sue Herrera now for our CNBC News update. Sue?
Good to see you, Kelly. Hello, everybody. Here's what's happening at this hour. The U.S. will be bringing back roughly 3,500 troops from Iraq over the next 2 to 3 months. That's according to the Wall Street Journal. That's about a one-third reduction. President Trump is expected to tout the move as progress in ending what he has called America's endless war. Children with COVID-19 may be exhaling the virus for several weeks, even if they never develop any symptoms. That's according to a new study that was published earlier today. Herbalife has agreed to pay more than $122 million to settle charges it made illegal payments to government officials in China in exchange for sales licenses and other benefits, and then falsified its books and records to hide them. And Russia has released previously classified video of the largest nuclear explosion ever, the Soviet Union's detonation of what is known as the Tsar Bomba, almost 60 years ago. Pretty incredible video. That is the news update this hour. Kelly, I'll send it back to you.
All right, Sue, thank you very much. Now, as the medical community makes more strides towards a vaccine, Stifel says there are a number of stocks that'll be big winners after a breakthrough. Some of them are under the radar. Let's start with One Spa World, ticker OSW. They operate health and wellness centers on cruise ships and resorts. They're down 58% this year, but almost tripled from the 52-week low, now up 188%. They're small, market cap just $713 million. Also on Stifel's list is Lindblad, ticker LIND. They're an expedition travel company, down 38% year to date, but 233% off the lows this year. The stock also on the smaller side, around $500 million. Finally, SeaWorld having a bad year so far, but seeing a nice rebound, doubling more so. It's now up 216%, almost more than tripling from its lows. The company announcing earlier this week the launch of a new park in San Diego that will open soon. For the rest of Stifel's picks, you can head to cnbc.com/pro. Now, the Federal Reserve has taken unprecedented steps since the shutdown began, thrusting Fed Chair Jay Powell into the limelight. Steve Leisman joins me now with a closer look at the evolution of Mr. Powell. Steve?
Kelly, thanks. When Fed Chair Jay Powell came to the job in 2018 as the first non-economist chair since Paul Volcker in the 80s, he expressed respect for economists and economics, but skepticism. His biggest beef, how key economic theories didn't work so well in practice. Ideas like the neutral interest rate, or R-star, kept changing. Unlike celestial stars, he said in his speech last year at Jackson Hole, these stars move unpredictably and cannot be directly observed. The historic change to average inflation targeting announced yesterday by the Fed came after 15 Fed listening events, and it reflects the unanimous approval of all 17 members of the Federal Market Committee. But it's also the result of the evolution of Powell. The Fed implemented inflation targeting in 2012 under then Chairman Ben Bernanke, a leading monetary policy expert. But over time, Powell began to see an inherent flaw. The public will always anticipate rate hikes once inflation moves towards the target. So you never hit the target. The Fed was really chasing its tail by moving to average inflation targeting. Powell and the Fed are hoping to try to convince the public that inflation can rise to the target and above it in order to average 2% over time. The other big change announced yesterday also reflects Powell's observation of how economic theory can fall short in action. The Fed kept waiting for low unemployment to spark inflation, but the rate kept falling. Inflation kept not appearing. And yet Powell could see tremendous social gains from low unemployment. In this year's virtual Jackson Hole speech, he said the strong labor market that prevailed before the pandemic was generating employment opportunities for many Americans who in the past had not found jobs readily available, especially low-income Americans. Now, the Fed is going to let the economy run with low unemployment and worry about inflation when or if it really shows up. All that's part of the change of Powell from outsider to trailblazer. Now, Kelly, we wait to see what it means in practice and whether it's right.
But it's so fascinating, Steve, you're right, from an outsider to a trailblazer. And I don't think any of us would have thought at the time, you know, this is going to be the guy who's trailblazing to a new, I mean, just because we could never have seen the nature of the of what he's confronting come. And they seem oddly to be matched well to one another. So let's talk about some of the risks, though. I mean, so far, as we go through the pandemic, so good, but there are plenty of risks to his new strategies.
I think that's right, Kelly. You know, I think I can get them all on one hand, which is sort of good news that it's only one hand, and bad news that it probably fills up all five, includes all five fingers. You know, you have asset bubble problems. There's an assumption underneath it, Kelly, that they can address inflation when it comes. So those are the issues they're going to have to deal with. I think it's okay for a while. Also, questions about how to calibrate this idea. He said it wasn't a mathematical formula, so we kind of got to feel our way in figuring out what the Fed is going to do. There are definitely risks involved, but right now it seems like the better bet to let unemployment run lower and worry about inflation later.
All right, Steve, thank you. Steve Leisman here charting Fed Chair Powell's course. Coming up, the PC comeback. Apple says no to Facebook. Uber employees sue Uber. And the retailer who saw online sales jump 200% last quarter. It's all ahead in rapid fire right after this. Welcome back. Let's catch you up on a few stories that should be on your radar today. It is time for Rapid Fire. Here to break down the headlines, Dominic Chu. We welcome back Rahel Solomon and introduce Mr. John Ford. And first up, there is a pandemic PC boom, and that's good news for companies like HP Inc. The CEO joined Jim Cramer on Mad Money last night with his reaction to the quarter.
We had never shipped so many PCs, and it was really driven by the demand we see for people working from home and learning from home. In the past, we were talking about one PC per home. Now we see the need to have one PC per person. So this is going to be driving demand that is going to be staying with us for a while.
And Dell seeing a similar trend, saying they also saw robust demand for notebooks. Both stocks higher today, John, by about 6%. The PC's back, but it's not like the Mac is not, right? I mean, it's just the point is people are buying computers like never before.
Yeah, Apple saw a huge bump, too. I mean, in the quarter that they just reported, it was like a holiday quarter for the PCs and iPads. When you think about it, this follows through into education. In normal times, you've got a PC lab, a computer lab, you've got maybe an iPad cart, and these things are shared between kids and between classrooms. Now you can't have that. You got to send these things home. Kids got to learn at a distance. It's one-to-one, and either the schools are going to buy them or the households have to, Kelly.
Dom, we're seeing shortages of laptops, you know, a lot of schools struggling to get their hands on them. And, I mean, you can the resale market right now is just huge. Like, they're going like hotcakes.
An acceleration of a trend that was already going into play, right? We talked about this idea that, when you and I were going to school, nobody really had, like, a laptop for every person out there. These days, you cannot really go to school at the college level without one. Now it's coming down to high school, middle school, and even elementary school. The issue is whether or not these trends last past the COVID-19 pandemic. I see the same thing with the golf industry. There's a huge move there. A lot of that demand is there, but will it last? And that's the key question for a lot of computers out there. I really don't know. I haven't used a laptop probably for like 6 to 9 months prior to the COVID-19 pandemic. And I finally fired up my Dell Alienware after like 6 months.
Like, is you an iPad guy, or is it all on your phone?
No, I mean, it's all on my phone or my iPad, yes. But finally, I started to use the computer because I was doing so much more stuff on there, the webcams, all the applications, the Microsoft Office suites, everything else I was using was all on the laptop. And then I got one for work as well to kind of keep church and state separate. So I've got two laptops
I'm with
at home
you.
Now.
Yeah, so Rahel, okay, I'm a laptop girl. I think there's a little bit of a male-female divide. Maybe I'm wrong. The males out there seem to love their iPads, but I don't know. I like the laptop. What can I say?
I'm more of a laptop person, too, especially for online shopping, which, speaking of online shopping, this trend is also lifting companies like Best Buy, which have seen really strong demand. But to Dom's point, you do wonder how long this sticks around, because once everyone has a laptop or an iPad, you know, and your dog has a laptop and your grandma has an iPad, I mean, how long do those trends stick around? At some point, you know, you've gotten your fill.
That, and see, this is the key point for all of these stocks that are outperforming right now, Rahel. So it's, okay, are you changing the future? Are you accelerating the future? Or are you bringing it forward and you're going to face this hangover? I mean, and in this case, you have to wonder, are people going to need to stock up on this stuff for 5 years after this point?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a very, very good point. I mean, I have one iPad, one work phone, one personal phone, one laptop. I mean, but I think I'm good for a couple of years. So, you know, I don't know how often I'll be in Best Buy or purchasing another Dell computer in the future. It's a good point, Kelly.
But Kelly, and John and I think we've been old enough covering these companies. Remember, John, back in the day when we used to talk about the upgrade cycle so much for companies like Intel or these PC makers? It feels like I haven't talked about an upgrade cycle for personal computers in a while. Maybe we're going to be talking about upgrade cycles in 2 to 3 years because everyone needs to replace those laptops and everything else all over again.
No, we are. I mean, my kids are playing Fortnite on laptops now. They love it. You know, they love these more powerful devices. They didn't really care so much before. But, yeah, when it gets older, they're definitely going to want it replaced. And the question is going to be, are the parents going to pony up?
John, that should be another podcast name for you, Fortnite. Like, they'd be like John After Hours. Like,
well, that would be a different kind of podcast, wouldn't it, Kelly?
Yes, it would.
I'm not going to say anything. Right, I'm just going to sit right here.
Moving right along, there is a tech showdown looming in Silicon Valley after Apple rejected a Facebook app update that would tell users the iPhone maker takes a 30% cut of in-app purchases. As part of the feature, it lets small businesses sell tickets to online events. Facebook wanted to include a line above the fine print that would say Apple takes 30% of this purchase. And this was after Apple refused to waive that 30% fee on this new feature. So clearly, Fort, this is just, I mean, how much are these companies really fighting each other?
Yeah, they're really fighting. Nice try, Facebook. I mean,
yeah.
Clearly, Apple views the App Store as very much like a retail store where they get to screen what comes in. They set the rules. Good luck protesting inside of somebody's store against their own problem. I mean, you can protest outside the store, but inside the store, I don't think so. Nobody's going to let you do that. Apple certainly isn't.
Can I just say something here? I agree with John here because I feel like that's the situation that's setting up. But here's the thing. If the whole retail world was only hypothetically, say, Walmart and Target, right? Only those two stores, would you have a right to go in there and protest some of the policies because it is, say, monopolistic or some kind of behavior like that? And so maybe that's the reason why I kind of, this made me think a little bit. I'm not sure exactly how I feel about that.
Because the optics just
aren't great. Go ahead, Rael, yeah.
Yeah, the optics just aren't great. Apple against small business. I mean, I get it. Apple's trying to be fair, but I just don't know. The optics just don't seem that great, especially in this
but
time.
Like,
go ahead,
Fort. Facebook's small business now. I mean, I'm trying to squeeze out a tear for Facebook because they don't have a megaphone loud enough to say something that they want to say. Come on. Facebook has the biggest megaphone in the world right now. If they really want to say something anywhere else other than inside Apple space, they can do it. Sure, maybe this doesn't make Apple look so great, but it's hard for me to pull out the little violin for Facebook.
I still think the walls are closing in on this App Store thing, but apparently I'm the only one because investors don't care. You know, this it just shows no sign of seeing this as a real setback. We'll see. I think it's going to play out for some time. Let's talk some Gap. We haven't talked Gap in a while, but they pivoted their supply chain to make face masks early on in the pandemic, and it really paid off. The retailer just reported $130 million of sales in face masks in the latest quarter. That includes to consumers, but also to bulk clients, guys. The city of New York, the state of California, Kaiser Permanente, Dom. The stock's still down about 2% on the year, but is this a new, you know, line of business for them? It just seems like a one-off.
Oh, no, I mean, it could be a one-off, but I applaud them and all the other businesses out there, small, medium, and large, that made the necessary pivots they had to make during the COVID-19 pandemic. I mean, some would say it's profiteering, but listen, if you're a business owner out there, whether publicly traded or not, what you were trying to do was find a way to actually make up for some of the lost revenue. Now, let's not forget that a company like Gap had to close stores, physically speaking. They had to kind of retilt their business, whether or not it was an omni-channel retail approach, whether or not they were trying to bulk up specifically e-commerce. One of the ways that they made it up was in making masks.
Yeah.
And these days, remember, this is a fashion, an apparel company at its very core, a retailer. It makes sense that they would kind of catch up on these trends. I have like 10 different kinds of masks, all in different designs right now, from different designers. It's become like a fashion accessory for me these days.
But Rael, that it goes back to your earlier point, which is there's some companies where they are, you know, changing the future or accelerating the future. And for Gap, they said, look, we take this as an example of how our corporate culture can be going forward. But what does that mean applied to other scenarios that don't include a pandemic? Or should they just have a standing business making masks or only wearing them for a while?
I don't know. I mean, I hope we're not going to be wearing them for a while, Kelly, or maybe I just need to get more masks and make them more fashionable like Dom. But it is a really good example of a company that's pivoting. Another company that we heard from recently that's also benefiting from the face mask trend, Etsy. Remember the last time we heard from them and their earnings, they said that they made $346 million, or they sold $346 million worth of masks in their second quarter. So clearly people are trying to accessorize with their masks. I haven't quite gotten there. I'd sort of, you know, begrudgingly grab mine and just throw it on. But
I know. I use the disposable ones myself. All right, next up, nearly 200 current and former Uber employees are suing the company, accusing it of putting them at risk of larger tax bills by pushing up the date of when their restricted stock units would become shares. They moved it up to when Uber went public, so employees were responsible for the income tax at the IPO price of $45. Instead of 6 months later, when the shares would have been 40% lower, Uber says these claims are simply without merit. John, they would have had to have known when they did this a couple days before the IPO that the shares were, you know, going to fall, I guess, or didn't look great in order to be accountable.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's a case to be made that they had a sense of demand. And from the employee perspective, I mean, this is adding insult to injury. I mean, you have the stock price dropping, and yes, the company does withhold a certain amount for taxes from that RSU amount, but then you're hit with the extra tax bill in payroll taxes later. So this really hurts. I mean, Uber's in a position now, if it values its employees, where it's got to kind of make them feel better about this. The whole point of giving them the RSUs was as a privilege, and that really backfires when an IPO is mispriced.
Yeah, Don, we see plenty of IPOs that don't go off all that great. It's a little bit rarer to see lawsuits about it.
It's just strange to me because we would not be having this conversation right now if Uber shares were higher. Right. Mm-hmm. If Uber shares were higher, what you could then just do is sell some of the appreciated stock to fund and some of the liability on the tax side of things. It's the fact that you now have a stock that's lower. And so part of me struggles with this because, you know, in the markets, things go up and things go down. Not
right.
every single IPO goes higher in this whole process. And if the tax liability is part of your compensation, guess what? It's part of your compensation.
Yeah, but Dom, this isn't like Kellogg or, I don't know, Goodyear. Or this is Uber, and they were told a story. Employees were told this story, and the stock was supposed to be worth so much more. It was changing the world for transportation and for practically everything. And so for the company to make a change at the last minute that put the employees at a disadvantage when it has to do with the stock, that hurts.
So wait. So you're telling me that if they made that disclosure, those 200 people would have turned down the stock, right? Not taken the RSU, not taken the award, don't give me the shares, I don't want the tax liability? Is that what your point is?
I'm saying the change that they made right before the IPO to change when the pricing takes place and effectively what ended up hiking the tax liability for the employees hurts extra because of the way not only the company pitched itself to the world, but pitched itself to employees.
I guess my point is I don't think anybody would have turned down the stock even if those disclosures were made, I guess is my point.
Me and Raul are just sitting back
if they had known what was coming.
Yeah, like you guys go at it. But it is interesting, though, because John, to your point, the company at that point kind of knew about the demand, you know, and the fact, and I'm thinking about Airbnb kind of rushing to go out the door this year. Anyway, before we go, nobody puts beauty in a corner. Ulta's quarterly results beat analyst expectations. Online sales jumped more than 200%. That helped take the sting out of its same-store sales decline of only 27%. The CEO says she thinks demand will continue to be suppressed for the rest of the year. Shares are still down about 6% year-to-date, Rahel. The question is Ulta back? I mean, this was the stock of the decade, then kind of hit the skids for a little while. You know, is it doing something right as a result of COVID that can kind of set it up for the next chapter?
It certainly seems like they're being strategic. So they had these sort of grand reopening expectations or expansion expectations, and they're scaling those back. And also, they've done so well in e-commerce that although they still maintain that for the Ulta customer coming in and actually experiencing the shades and the brands, is still sort of the highlight of the experience. They're shifting more to e-commerce. And so the takeaway from the call yesterday for me was that the Ulta moving forward is still, you know, the Ulta, but they're changing a little bit. They're sort of changing their face a little bit. So we might start to see more digital investments in e-commerce. They're also saying that they're in the process, their real estate team is in the process of perhaps renegotiating some leases. So Ulta's in a unique position because they tend to have off-mall locations, and they're huge stores. So anything you want beauty-related, you can get at an Ulta. And so while sales are declining, people are spending more on skincare. You always need good skincare. fragrances and that sort of thing. And DIY, do it yourself.
And Dom, they're saving money on gas. So yes. It's all going to Ulta.
$700 and some million a day, apparently.
Crazy. Yeah. We'll see.
Shortage of demand doesn't surprise me. I don't know about you, Dom. I only wear makeup at work, not at home.
I probably wear more makeup than my wife does, and that's a sad commentary right there.
We'll let you go take it off right now. Dom Chu, Rahel Solomon, John Fort, and a very fun rapid fire today. Coming up, Janet Yellen and Jared Bernstein accusing Congress of neglecting its responsibilities in a blistering op-ed. Jared joins us next with a closer look at the pain he sees ahead for Americans and if the economy and Congress can't come together on more action. Tonight at 6 at Summer School with Frank Holland, taking your questions on high-flying stocks and financial planning to help you with your homework. 6 p.m. Eastern Time right here on CNBC. We're back in two. It has been nearly 4 full weeks since the $600 extra unemployment benefit expired. The next stage of pandemic relief is really nowhere in sight. This week, CNBC reported that Republicans are considering a narrow $500 billion COVID stimulus bill, nowhere near the amount that Democrats are proposing. Last night, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows did discuss stimulus. Afterwards, Pelosi issued a statement saying the nation is at a, quote, tragic impasse. A New York Times op-ed by former Fed Chair Janet Yellen and economist Jared Bernstein underscores this predicament. They say the Senate is on vacation while Americans starve. They warn that without stimulus, the economic recovery could downgrade or degrade to no growth at all. Jared Bernstein joins me now. He's a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. How'd you score a gig with Yellen, Jared? That's pretty big time.
Yeah, that was a real treat to get to write with Chair Yellen. She's so clear and thoughtful.
Was it her that came to you with this idea, or you went to her for kind of a little added oomph? Or tell me what you can about it.
Sure. We talk about the economy now and again. And as we were having a discussion about current conditions, about what the Fed's doing and what the fiscal authorities, the Congress, particularly Senate Republicans, are not doing, we thought we should write something about that. Really, what we wanted to get at was this idea that it's not just monetary or fiscal policy alone that are so necessary at a time like this. You really need the 1-2 punch. One of the things we said in the piece is that it's as if by holding credit rates so low and making sure that credit markets are flowing freely, the Fed kind of sets the table. But to get the diners to come into the restaurant, there you need fiscal policy to complete the deal.
Yeah, it's interesting because the Fed has done so much to provide liquidity this year. They've launched a number of different programs. You know, while Congress did PPP, I wonder if the Fed's success has made it less likely that Congress will follow up with anything else.
That is a risk. And, you know, one of the things that I think is very important right now is to listen to Chair Jay Powell, who's going to Congress every time he gets a chance and saying, we really need fiscal support to help really boost the impact of what we're doing. And one of the things that Chair Yellen and I remembered was that this is precisely the same thing that Ben Bernanke was saying at the beginning of the last expansion, which was also weaker than it should have been because the fiscal push just wasn't enough. Now, to be very clear, of course, Congress has done a significant amount thus far, but as you just pointed out, about a month ago, they dropped the ball. And the way I think of it, it's as if we're trying to build a fiscal bridge to the other side of the crisis, and Congress just stopped the construction way too early. And when I say Congress, I really am talking about the Senate Republicans who just have been so recalcitrant about closing this deal.
Well, let's not go there, because you know what they would say? They would say that it's the Democrats who've been recalcitrant. And so,
well, the Democrats actually passed a bill.
Yeah,
right?
a very large one, yes. And the economy has recovered more quickly. I think there's legitimate questions about the best way
Absolutely.
To structure this going forward.
No, if you're saying there's room for compromise, you're right, and I agree.
Right, but there's no way that the two sides are ever going to agree until kind of that final deadline and push really comes to shove. So that was kind of going to be my final question to you, which is, and we talked to Greg Ipp about this yesterday, but this idea of mission creep at the Fed, you know, because politics is hard and people disagree, they go, we'll just let the Fed take care of it. And that's been true for a lot of things lately with the pandemic, but it's even true of the Fed's mission going forward. You know, they're supposed to solve racial inequality and wealth inequality and address climate change and, you know, take all of these things into account. And frankly, under a Biden administration, one of the campaign goals is to make sure that the Fed takes those things into account as a policy. So is that just giving more of the people's power to the Fed?
Not really. I actually don't think that's an accurate way to describe some of the ideas, some of what people are talking about maybe. But for the most part, what a lot of us are talking about when we're talking about the Fed and racial equality, for example, is basically to keep doing not only what they're doing, but what they committed to doing yesterday. And that is to be data-driven in terms of inflation, not driven by estimates of a natural rate that have long been biased up at great expense to communities of color. So this is no new mandate. The mandate isn't full employment, price stability, and something else. It's making sure that the full employment part of the mandate gets appropriately weighted. And I think that's actually a very good interpretation of which Jay Powell, to his tremendous credit, announced yesterday.
Yeah, no, it certainly, I think the Fed has been trying for a long time to tell people we don't want to tighten prematurely. And by highlighting the impact on those communities especially, maybe that'll finally get across. Jared, thanks very much for joining me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for inviting me on.
Jared Bernstein of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, she said. Coming up, President Trump's payroll tax cut is scheduled to go into effect next week, but many workers aren't going to see any change in their paychecks. We will explain why next. Remember, you can always watch or listen to us live on the go on the CNBC app. We're back in a couple. Welcome back. President Trump's payroll tax cut is scheduled to go into effect next week, but many workers aren't going to see a change in their paychecks, and corporate America is throwing some cold water on the plan. Elon Moy is here with the latest. Elon?
Well, Kelly, businesses are warning that this is a no-win proposal, and that's because President Trump isn't actually cutting the 6.2% employee payroll tax. He's just allowing it to be deferred. So the question for businesses is, do they need to let each and every one of their employees decide whether to keep paying this tax or to push it off until next year? That, they say, would create an administrative nightmare. On the other hand, if businesses make a blanket decision to just defer this tax for all of their employees, some workers could face a nasty surprise come April 15th when they realize they actually owe the government money. A person making $35,000 a year, for example, could wind up owing more than $750. So a coalition of industry businesses is now cautioning that many of our members will likely decline to implement deferral, choosing instead to continue to withhold and remit to the government the payroll taxes required by law, aka the status quo. So Kelly, the other challenge here is that these payroll taxes are used to fund Social Security. If they were not to be paid back, that would blow a $100 billion hole in the Social Security Trust Fund and move up the insolvency date by a couple of months. Back over to you.
Still, this is one of the most bizarre things I've ever heard that, you know, hey, businesses and get a tax cut, but they say, yeah, we're going to keep sending the money to the government.
Right. Well, so part of the problem here is that the person who owes the tax is not the person who is in charge of collecting the money and paying the tax. And that discrepancy is why this is such an administrative nightmare for businesses. And workers just don't know what to do, and they don't want to have that tax bill come April 15th. So many people rely on that refund, Kelly.
Oh, can you imagine? I mean, obviously they want to make sure people don't have to turn around and pay out of pocket. I guess it's a lose-lose. Elon, thanks very much. We'll see if anything changes ahead of that. Elon Moy, that does it for The Exchange. But still ahead on Power Lunch, Abbott Labs getting the green light from the FDA for a $5, 15-minute rapid COVID test. The CEO joins us live for an exclusive interview about that ahead. I'll see you on Power Lunch with Brian Sullivan right after this.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate. Pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.